Most viewers who flip on HBO are used to hearing this. Or maybe this. These shows are far from their humble beginnings. If you really want to get a sense of the origins of HBO, wrap your head around this for a moment. On November 8, 1972, the town of Wilkes-Barre, Pennsylvania, is digging out from Hurricane Agnes.
Get out now. Get out now. There's still time, but this is the warning that the river is starting to come over your dike.
Work on the dike has ceased. The water is expected to break through.
Back in the summer, the storm ravaged the town with 85-mile-an-hour winds and sent the nearby Susquehanna River surging over its dikes and into people's homes. Now, on this fall Wednesday, another storm is fast approaching. Charles Dolan, an entrepreneur from Cleveland, feels his gut clench as he tracks the devastation. It's not that his home is at stake, it's his dream that's in trouble. Dolan's worried that this next storm will blow down the lines to his first 325 customers. See, Dolan's got this business he's developed, a pay TV channel. He calls it Home Box Office. Maybe you've heard of it. Weeks before, Dolan and his sales crew descended on Wilkes-Barre to pitch this new channel to people who'd been living in a disaster zone for months. The roads are still underwater. And yet somehow Dolan and his salesmen convince residents to pay $6 a month for the cable service, for what they call special programming. Now, upon closer inspection, what that special programming amounts to are some pretty bad movies and sports from Madison Square Garden. On this November evening, the schedule for Dolan's special channel includes a New York Rangers hockey game and a two-year-old B-movie called Sometimes a Great Notion. On this night, Dolan's channel gets overshadowed by the local TV weather report. Dolan gets in his car anyway, slogs through the storm to the headquarters of the local cable company, presses a button to turn on the feed for his channel, and waits. The clouds roll in. The wind howls. The cable wires strain. But everything holds together. Throughout the night, despite everything nature throws at him, Dolan's cable service is working. And in just a few years, Home Box Office will be playing on a much larger field than Wilkes-Barre, Pennsylvania. And this, well, this will become familiar to TV viewers all around the world. The first cable cast in 1948 compressed over-the-air broadcast signals into wires, sending those signals out to connected homes in rural Oregon, Arkansas, and Pennsylvania. Now, this was 48. To the first people who laid cable for television signals, this was just a way to get broadcast TV to places where they couldn't pick up TV signals using rabbit ears or rooftop antennas. In other words, this was a workaround. But Charles Dolan didn't see it that way. See, to him, those wires looked like television's future. He saw conduits, pipelines for sending across huge streams of movies and live sports to homes all over the country. In fact, he dreamed that one day, people could order up whatever movies they wanted and have them delivered over these very same cable lines. First, he tested the idea by wiring up hotel rooms in New York on a closed-circuit system that carried local news and tourist information. From there, Dolan got a city contract to wire Lower Manhattan with cable to fix dead zones, places where skyscrapers got in the way of the broadcast TV signals. It was a good idea, but the cost was astronomical. After wiring just a few dozen blocks, Dolan went broke. But it did prove something to him. His idea could work. It was just, well, it would just be hugely expensive. He needed to find a partner, preferably one with deep pockets.
If you travel, you know when it comes to love.
See you soon.
Can't wait.
The sky is no limit. You know with your Delta Amex card, being oceans apart means meeting in Aruba. And booking a war travel with your card means saving 15% on Delta flights. You know kissing under the bridge of sighs guarantees eternal love. Because you're the long-distance lovebirds. It's why you're a Delta SkyMiles Platinum American Express card member. If you travel, you know. Take off 15 discount not applicable to partner-operated flights or taxes and fees. Terms apply. Visit go.amex/you know.
You know, Audible has a brand new collection of exclusive thrillers. Every move is made more exciting by captivating sound design, eerie soundscapes, and dynamic performances. I just downloaded The Grand Opening by Carl Weber. It's a mystery about a family business in a small southern town, and there are secrets around every turn. You know, when I'm listening, the time just disappears, getting completely immersed in the story and the performances. And as an Audible member, you get to keep one title a month from their entire catalog, including bestsellers and new releases. So come on, listen along. New members can try Audible now free for 30 days. Head on over to audible.com/BW or just text BW to 500-500. That's audible.com/BW or text BW to 500-500 to try Audible free for 30 days.
From Wondery, this is Business Wars. I'm David Brown. In our last episode, well, it was after the Great Recession, remember? Netflix was about to meet HBO on the battlefield that the premium cable network had dominated for decades, original content. But today, we're taking a step back here to explore how HBO, what used to be called home box office, went from serving B-movies to some 325 homes in Wilkes-Barre, Pennsylvania, to become the juggernaut of original shows and movies that it is today. The standard by which all other cable companies would one day have to measure themselves. But back before Dolan set up shop in Wilkes-Barre, there were a few painful pit stops along the way. First, Dolan needed money. That's where Time Incorporated, the publishing giant, came in. Time Incorporated was looking for new ways to expand its media presence beyond magazines and books. So the company sinks $30 million into Dolan's cable idea. Thing is, no one's signing up. Dolan's dream is in danger of flatlining because Dolan has to convince customers to pay for something they already get for free. TV. Pay for TV? Why would anyone pay for the stuff they could get over the air for free? Exactly. Bingo. Dolan needs to offer something the networks don't have, the stuff people can't get from NBC, ABC, or CBS. So in 1968, Dolan makes a first-of-its-kind deal with Madison Square Garden, the arena in New York City. He makes the deal to broadcast live sports exclusively on his new cable channel. But there's one catch. He isn't allowed to carry any games in towns within a certain radius of Manhattan. That would cut into ticket sales. And there are other competitors, too, like the National Association of Theater Owners. They're worried that if channels like Home Box Office put movies on TV, well, that'll eat into their ticket sales. So the theater owners ramp up a campaign called Crusade for Free TV, warning people that paying for cable will eventually lead to the end of free TV. And that pitch starts to work. In California, lawmakers pass a bill outlawing pay TV. This is not a good sign for Dolan. So he decides best to start small. In some out-of-the-way place, low profile. He's got to get his operation off the ground before television companies or government regulators start to take notice and get antsy. So, on November 8, 1972, the residents of peaceful Wilkes-Barre unwittingly take part in what amounts to the first shot in an entertainment revolution. Warner Cable's Star Channel and a third pay TV channel called Theater Vision arrive about a year later, and they want in on the action. But in that first year, Home Box Office wages an all-out war for just 8,000 subscribers. And they do it with the one weapon they have, mostly second-rate programming. But if we've learned anything from Netflix, it's that with the right outlet to customers, well, you can build an audience from just about anything. And by just about anything, I mean even content that's laughably bad. Stuff you might think no one is really going to watch. Yep, polka music. In 1973, 60,000 people plopped down $6 a month to watch the Pennsylvania Polka Festival on home box office. Time Incorporated likes what it sees. Not the content, mind you, but the concept. The company purchases Dolan's share of HBO. With more capital behind it, HBO is able to add more quality movies to the lineup. Also, uncensored stand-up comedy. It adds in sports commentary like Inside the NFL and Race for the Pennant and live boxing and tennis. And these shows are going up against some pretty big hits on free TV, programs like The Waltons, The Mary Tyler Moore Show, and All in the Family. Even with offbeat content, there's something different, a little more grown up about HBO. Now, these are the early days before HBO has really defined itself. And they're testing the waters, taking advantage of the fact that, unlike broadcast TV, there are no seven dirty words on HBO. In fact, since the federal government doesn't regulate cable the way it does broadcast TV, HBO can show nudity and sexual situations in late-night fare, stuff that tiptoes between porn and foreign erotica. This is the stuff the big three networks can't come close to offering. Turn on HBO after midnight, and you're likely to find movies like Emmanuel and Lady Chatterley's Lover. One look at the screen, and the difference is pretty obvious. So obvious, in fact, that it would become their slogan years later. It's not TV, it's HBO. By 1975, HBO is ready to go national. Then, it runs smack into a roadblock. Entrenched technology that everyone calls Ma-Bell. The phone company demands $25 million in transmission fees to let HBO grow beyond New York and Pennsylvania. Well, HBO isn't making anything close to that kind of money. Not yet, anyway. And besides, this feels like extortion. HBO executives are frustrated. They're looking for an alternative, so they gamble on doing it themselves. They invest in new satellite technology to carry HBO's signal nationwide. Now, HBO's not held hostage to AT&T anymore. But those satellites give them something more, too. An unexpected global reach with an instant payoff.
Ladies and gentlemen, the Thriller in Manila.
In 1975, HBO buys the rights to the Thriller from Manila heavyweight title fight between Muhammad Ali and Joe Frazier. It's one of the greatest boxing matches of all time. Americans watch the fight live from the Philippines, and they are electrified. Viewers finally get it. With HBO, it's not just that they can watch stuff you can't find anywhere else. It's stuff that's interesting and fun to watch. And they start signing up for HBO at a rate of 30,000 new subscribers a month. By 1980, HBO has more than 1 million subscribers nationwide. Cable is becoming the new Wild West, and HBO has the biggest draw. People are literally chasing cable trucks down the street to have their homes hooked up. But on top of the basic cable channels, HBO now has competition from pay channels. Viacom's Showtime, the Movie Channel, the Home Theater Network, and the Disney Channel. But there's a problem. They're all going after the same reheated movies, and subscribers start getting sick of it. Soon, subscriber growth for all pay TV channels begins to stall. In the early 1980s, Bill Macy Jr. is working in HBO corporate communications. He knows things have to change dramatically. It can't keep going this way. And he lays it out for the marketing team. The consumers see it, and they're saying, I'm not paying this kind of money to see the same old movies I've already seen on regular TV 100 times. HBO needs something to excite subscribers again, to make them want to pay for TV again. We need to do something different, something fresh. When you get them into the tent, you got to have something to show them. We need to bulk up our programming. Okay, but no direct-to-video titles. That stuff's trash. Well, maybe just a couple, but only the really good ones. Meshi identifies the problem, all right, but he's not the man who would find the solution. In fact, the person who would do that would not only fix the problem, he would redefine HBO. And his name is, you guessed it, Jeff Bukas. We heard about Bukas in the 2000s when he had already gone on to run all of Time Warner, one of the world's largest media companies. But in 1997, Bukas is a 25-year-old MBA looking to mint money at a New York investment bank in the commercial lending department. And he looks the part, too. Tall, slender, well-dressed, polished. Then a friend tells him about HBO. Friend says he watched a movie the night before, only months after it screened in the theaters. Really? This intrigues and confuses Bukas. Where did you see it? On the Monday night movie? No. It's not on the networks, Jeff. You don't know about HBO? I mean, seriously, where you been? You mean pay TV? Yeah, something like that. Well, Bukas signs up that very night. And like Charles Dolan back in the 60s, he too sees the future in those cable lines. Bukas leaves his cushy job at Citibank to become a low-level salesman at HBO. He will eventually preside over the most successful expansion of original programming in television history. Bukas was number two when his boss, Michael Fuchs, starts pushing for original programming. Fuchs wants to make movies, stuff the networks won't touch, stuff they couldn't touch with cursing and mayhem and, yeah, more than a little skin, but in a tasteful way, of course. Starting in the early 80s, HBO programming starts pushing all of society's hot buttons. AIDS, abortion, homosexuality, corruption. HBO makes headlines with its racy lineup. Problem is, viewership is flat. Fuchs eventually leaves, and Bukas becomes CEO. Bukas knows what he is, a businessman, and what he isn't, a creative type. That lack of hubris carries him and HBO much further than one might think. Bukas brings on a talented programming chief, Chris Albrecht. They struggle hard to come up with a sensibility, a feel, something that will set HBO apart from the competition. Bukas gets the word out to writers. Hey, if you're doing something edgy that the networks pass on, bring it to HBO. Movies are fine, but they especially want series. Great series. Programs that hook people in, keep them asking what happens next, keep them paying their monthly fees. The problem is, HBO already has something of a reputation for making junk. Reviewers say the plot of the football show First and Ten seems to revolve around getting the team's cheerleaders naked at least once an episode. Same thing for The Hitchhiker, a thriller that was equal parts gore and bare breasts. So why would top-tier writers and producers want to be associated with the likes of that? Well, for starters, there are a lot of hungry writers in Hollywood, some talented hungry writers too, and they all want a shot at making their dream show. Bukas sees an opportunity, one that would forever change viewers' tastes. Bukas guarantees these frustrated scribes that there will be no studio interference, no rules, no ratings metrics. But in return, they have to deliver scripts that are no holds barred. If you come to us, the show is yours creatively. You finally get to write the scripts you used to dump in the trash because you worried they'd never make it past the network censors. How's that sound? Bukas ups the ante big time, tripling the original programming budget to $700 million. Though some at HBO worry that not only does Bukas not know what he's doing, he's risking the whole network in a high-stakes gamble. But these are some serious bets involving serious talent. Bukas and Albrecht give the green light to Steven Spielberg and Tom Hanks to make their blockbuster miniseries Band of Brothers for HBO. Although Bukas and Albrecht vow before meeting with Spielberg not to spend more than $90 million, The series actually comes in at 120 million. Bukas says nothing about the blown budget and never meddles in Spielberg's creative process. And HBO? Well, HBO rakes in the bucks on Band of Brothers in syndication and DVD sales. Bukas and Albrecht have found their secret recipe. Strong characters, adult themes, season-long story arcs, and great taste. Inside HBO, they develop a series of shows they call The Big Three, and they vault HBO to the top of the Hollywood food chain. They're gritty, adult stories that look without blinking at real-life problems with humor and depth. In 1998, HBO launches a glitzy series about the tribulations of four fashion and sex-obsessed New York girlfriends. Sex and the City talk bluntly about female sexuality, safe sex, and promiscuity in ways that were verboten on broadcast TV. But that show is a custard-filled Napoleon compared to what's in the pipeline. The next year, David Chase, an A-list writer, pitches the concept for a show about a mob boss who seeks therapy for job stress. Chase had already taken The Sopranos to the networks, but every single one of them had passed. Over-the-top violence and an unsympathetic cast of mobsters turned him off. But Chase had experience. He had written for the popular Rockford Files and Northern Exposure. HBO figures if they bring Chase aboard with The Sopranos, he'd be like bait to catch more top writers. HBO spends more than $3 million on the pilot. That's a whole lot more money than the typical network TV pilot. And then, focus groups give it the thumbs down. Bukas may not be a creative type, but he knows a hit when he sees it. So he pushes right past the bad data. Let's go for it. As long as we can keep making it at the same quality as the pilot, let's do this thing. The Sopranos becomes a monster hit, HBO's biggest, grabbing 112 Emmy nominations over six seasons. The Sopranos weaves itself into American culture as a modern Shakespearean tragedy. With the success of The Sopranos in its quiver, HBO approaches writer Alan Ball, who's just won an Oscar for the film American Beauty. They have an idea for a show about, wait for it, a funeral parlor. And they give Alan Ball one instruction: smash some china. Break all the rules. I don't care if the characters are likable as long as they're interesting. Ball comes back with 6 Feet Under, a blend of black humor and drama and non-sequential storylines. The word is out to Hollywood creatives that they can push the boundaries at HBO.
We get support from Airbnb. Staying in an Airbnb is often one of my favorite parts of a trip, especially on business travel. Instead of slogging to another hotel and waiting in line after you've been driving or flying all day, there is nothing better than landing in a place that, well, really feels like a home away from home. Maybe you've stayed in an Airbnb before and thought to yourself, you know, this actually seems pretty doable. Maybe my place could be an Airbnb. Well, I'm here to tell you it could be. You could be sitting on an Airbnb and not even know it. It might be as simple as starting with your spare room, or maybe even your whole place when you're away. Say you and your family are headed away for a much-deserved spring break. Well, why not Airbnb your place and make some extra money towards the trip? Win-win. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host. As business owners and managers, you use software for your business every day. You use one piece of software to manage your customers, another to manage your employees, another to manage your finances, and the list goes on. You buy these pieces independently and hope they fit neatly together like a puzzle. And then you find out the hard way that they don't, and you end up with a mess at the heart of your business operations. Does any of this sound familiar? Well, fortunately, Zoho offers a solution to this chaos. It's called Zoho One. Zoho One is a suite of around 50 pre-integrated business applications that fit together beautifully. So instead of dealing with disparate software from multiple vendors with multiple contracts and price points,
You deal with one vendor with all the pieces of the business software puzzle neatly put together, offered at a very attractive price. Now, if this sounds interesting to you, you got to check out Zoho One. At Zoho.one, that's Zoho.one. With Zoho, you're not just licensing apps. You're licensing peace of mind.
Viewers almost hate themselves for loving some of these HBO characters. As one reviewer puts it, sympathetic and interesting, yet unlikable and morally abhorrent. The reaction is always strongest when a storyline doesn't go the way viewers think it should. But here's the thing. HBO has kept its word to the creatives, and another golden age of television is born. The next programming milestone for HBO is The Wire.
If you walk through the garden.
About the connection between drug culture, politics, and media. It's a critical success. It shows just how far HBO would let writers push the limits. The Wire is a great example of Bukas's broad view of success. Return on investment isn't always measured in dollars. The Wire's ratings are low in the first few seasons, but the show gets rave reviews and it's cheap to make. Bukas knows that he needs people to flock to HBO and pay monthly dues, and the siren song of great reviews and great word of mouth is as good or better than cash. And boatloads of Emmy Awards don't hurt either. HBO starts piling up the golden statuettes in 2002 and has won more since than any other network. By the mid-2000s, Bukas and Albrecht are on a long hot streak. Their risky gut instinct bets have created a growing stable of shows that draw in new subscribers and earn serious cash when they hit reruns. The Sopranos, Sex and the City, and Band of Brothers bring in record-setting licensing fees when the rights sell to basic cable. HBO's business balloons to 29 million subscribers and nearly $4 billion in revenue by the time HBO runs the final episode of The Sopranos in 2007. By that point, the name HBO is synonymous with quality. But with Sex and the City, The Sopranos, and 6 Feet Under all ending their long runs, well, people start asking, what's next? Is HBO's dominance only as strong as its latest shows? Would viewers keep watching when the big three were gone? Other cable channels have taken a page from HBO's premium television playbook and start creating critically acclaimed shows of their own. AMC scores with Mad Men, a show that HBO had seen the script for and declined to make. And then, in what would amount to an historic turning point in television history, another question surfaces. Would fickle audiences turn off HBO just because they don't like a particular episode? That question comes up in 2007 in the final episode of The Sopranos. Mob boss Tony Soprano sits in a diner in New Jersey as his family arrives for dinner. He watches warily as sketchy types walk by their table. The audience senses this will end badly. It's just that nobody knows how. Would Tony and his family get offed or somehow survive again? And then... In the final seconds, the screen suddenly goes black. No one knows how the scene just ended. Some think their cable went out. People are screaming at their television sets. HBO has seared this scene into television history, but its most successful shows are gone.
Hey, Prime members, you can binge every episode of Business Wars ad-free on Amazon Music. Download the Amazon Music app today. Or you can listen ad-free with Wondery Plus in Apple Podcasts. Before you go, tell us about yourself by completing a short survey at wondery.com/survey.
On the next episode of Business Wars, can HBO maintain its dominance as more players get into the premium content game, including a certain former DVD rental company called Netflix? I hope you enjoyed this episode of Business Wars. I'm your host, David Brown. Gina Keating, author of the book Netflix, wrote this story. Karen Lowe is our senior producer and editor. Sound design by Jeff Schmidt. Our executive producers are Ben Adair, Marshall Louie, and Hernan Lopez for Wondery.
I'm Trey Wingo.
And I'm Kevin Frazier. We're teaming up on a new weekly sports podcast from Wondery, Alternate Routes.
As former SportsCenter anchors and current sports obsessives, we're consumed by all the what-if questions that make being a sports fan so excruciatingly fun.
If you're like us, then you also live and die on the fallout from every drop pass, busted draft pick, and game-changing play.
Or play call.
Intercepted at the goal line by Malcolm Butler.
Sorry, Marshawn, still too soon. Each week on Alternate Routes, we'll take a flashpoint in sports, break down what actually happened, then explore every alternate scenario and the ripple effects it would have caused.
Follow and listen to Alternate Routes on the Wondery app or wherever you get your podcasts. You can listen ad-free by joining Wondery Plus in the Wondery app or on Apple Podcasts.
I mean, the possibilities are limitless, Kevin.
What if Portland drafted Michael Jordan?
What if the NBA never vetoed the Chris Paul trade to the Lakers?
That's a butterfly effect.